Chapter 12. Heroes. We're not talking about small H heroes here. Given a smidgen of courage and a suitable crisis, practically anybody could turn out to be a small H hero. But a capital H hero is a star in the firmament of myth and legend, a precious asset to any bard or storyteller who happens to meet him. People hoping for a quiet life are less enthusiastic, since a considerable amount of mayhem erupts wherever a hero passes, even one who is seeking justice rather than, say, the green eye of the little yellow god. Heroes come in two main types, the heir to the kingdom and the barbarian. Both are recognizable by certain signs, well known to anyone who knows anything about folklore and the power of narrativium, and abound in the semi-historical legends of many nations. Less common is the first, or culture, hero, found on the Discworld and in certain earthly mythologies. Yet since he is the most ancient of the three, it is only right to begin with him. The First Hero. In the myths and folklore of some lands, there are tales of a first hero who walked the earth at the dawn of time, bringing mankind essential gifts and skills, without which society could not survive. Such a hero is more than human, but he is not a god. Indeed, he may be acting in defiance of gods who wish to keep men helpless and ignorant. In one way, he is the opposite of the barbarian hero, since he brings civilization, not mere pillage and carnage. Some therefore call him the culture hero. His courage is the courage of endurance. On the disc, the first hero's name is Mazda. A remarkable coincidence, since on Earth there is a morally admirable deity called Mazda, who is the god of light, truth, and justice, in Zoroastrianism, the ancient religion of Persia, Iran. He is the power of good, locked in combat with the evil Ahriman, whom he will defeat at the last day. The Discworld's Mazda is not so exalted, but he too worked for good and suffered for it. Of course, much depends on the point of view, since an unsympathetic mind would say that what he did was theft. He stole fire from the gods. I thought I'd start off with the legend of how Mazda stole fire for mankind in the first place, said the minstrel.
Nice, said Cohen.
And then a few verses about what the gods did to him.
Did to him? Did to him? Said Cohen. They made him immortal.
Yes. In a way, I suppose.
What do you mean, in a way?
It's classical mythology, Cohen, said the minstrel. I thought everyone knew. He was chained to a rock for eternity, and every day an eagle comes and pecks out his liver.
I'm not much of a reader, said Cohen. Chained to a rock? For a first offence? He's still there?
Eternity isn't finished yet, Cohen.
He must have had a big liver.
It grows again every night, according to legend, said the minstrel. Cohen stared at the distant clouds that hid the snowy top of the mountain.
He brought fire to everyone, and the gods did that to him, eh? Well, we'll have to see about that.
From the Last Hero. This is indeed, as the minstrel says, a classical myth. In ancient Greece, it was the story of Prometheus, the benefactor of mankind, maybe even the creator of mankind, for some old writers claim that he formed the bodies of the first men and women from water and clay, after which the goddess Athene breathed life into them. Whether that is true or not, all agree that he brought them civilization, teaching them the skills he had himself learned from Athene, metalworking, building, mathematics, astronomy, medicine, to the great anger of Zeus, who had intended them to remain ignorant. And then, to cap it all, Prometheus stole fire from the gods. He lit a torch from the chariot of the sun, broke off a smouldering ember, hid it in a hollow stalk of fennel, and so carried it down to the earth, as a gift to humanity. Furious, Zeus had Prometheus stripped naked and chained to a rock in the Caucasian mountains. Every day at dawn, a monstrous bird, part griffin and part vulture, would fly down and tear his body open, pecking out and eating his liver. Every night, as he lay freezing, his liver would grow again, ready for the dawn. Yet he knew he would be released one day. And so it was. When Prometheus had spent 1,000 years fettered to the rock, or some say 10,000, Heracles, a hero of the wild and monster-slaying type, persuaded Zeus to let him shoot the griffin vulture through the heart, and set Prometheus free. The barbarian hero came to the rescue of the culture hero, on Earth as on the disk. The Royal Heir. The people of Ankh-Morpork know all about heirs who arrive incognito to claim their rightful kingdom, and then turn out to be ideal rulers, brave, wise, and just. The throne had been empty for more than 2,000 years, since the death of the last of the line of the kings of Ankh. Legend said that one day the city would have a king again, and went on with various comments about magic swords, strawberry birthmarks, and all the other things that legends gabble on about in these circumstances. From Sorcery. What is more, pretty well all of them know the rumour that such an heir is currently living in the city, as a mere watchman, and they can put a name to him, Captain Carrot Iron Founderson. A conspiracy to groom Nobby Nobbs for the role failed utterly. In fact, the only person who seems unaware of the rumour is Carrot himself. He is a foundling. He has a strong sword, well used, though quite unmagical and lacking any mysterious inscriptions. He has an oddly shaped birthmark, rather like a crown. But still, he resists the pressures of narrativium, and goes around ignoring his manifest destiny in a most irritating manner. Perhaps there have been Carrots on Earth, but if so, their strategy has been so successful that nobody has ever heard of them. In that universe, the nearest thing to Carrot's attitude is the naive simplicity of the teenage Arthur. As is well known, he had no idea he was a dead king's son, and was simply acting as squire to his elder foster brother, Sir Kay. Kay needed a replacement sword to use in a tournament, and sent Arthur to find one. Arthur wandered off into a churchyard, where he noticed something which he thought would come in useful. As Mannery writes in his Mort d'Arthur, "There was seen in the churchyard a great stone four square, like unto a marble stone, and in the midst thereof was like an anvil of steel, a foot on high, and therein stuck a fair sword, naked by the point, and letters there were written in gold about the sword, that said thus, Whoso pulleth out this sword of this stone and anvil, is rightwise king born of all England." Without bothering to read the inscription, Arthur casually pulled the sword out and took it to Kay. When people realized where it had come from, and also that when it was put back, nobody but Arthur could get it to move at all, he was acknowledged to be the long-lost heir. One might easily assume that this was the famed Excalibur, which Arthur always bore in battle, but Mallory says not. According to his account, the sword drawn from the stone was broken 2 or 3 years later in a duel between Arthur and Pellinor, but Merlin promised to find him another. So they rode till they came to a lake, the which was a fair water and broad, and in the midst of the lake Arthur was ware of an arm, clothed in white samite, that held a fair sword in that hand. "Lo," said Merlin, "yonder is that sword that I spake of." With that, they saw a damosel going upon the lake. "What damosel is that?" said Arthur. "That is the Lady of the Lake," said Merlin. "Speak ye fair to her, that she will give you that sword." And so they went into the ship, and when they came to the sword that the hand held, Sir Arthur took it up by the handles, and took it with him, and the arm and the hand went under the water. This is the true Excalibur, the one which the dying Arthur ordered Sir Bedivere to throw into a lake. Then Sir Bedivere took up the sword and went to the waterside, and there he bound the girdle about the hilts, And then he threw the sword as far into the water as he might. And there came an arm and an hand above the water, and met it, and caught it, and so shook it thrice, and brandished, and then vanished away the hand with the sword in the water. Whether King Arthur ever really died is a mystery. True, there was a tomb for him in the medieval Glastonbury Abbey, but it was a fake, and rumours abounded. As Malory wrote, "Some men say in many parts of England that King Arthur is not dead, but had by the will of our Lord Jesu into another place, and men say that he shall come again, and he shall win the Holy Cross. I will not say it shall be so, but rather I will say, here in this world he changed his life. But many men say that there is written upon his tomb this verse, Hic jacet Arthurus, rex quondam, rex cu, futurus. Here lies Arthur, former king, and future king." This is no longer the tale of a lost heir. This is a hero of another sort. The sleeping king under the mountain, the king who will come back from another place to save his people and achieve heroic feats. A tale we have met already in Lancrey and elsewhere. It is a powerful narrative pattern, widely scattered through the multiverse, as a consolation and a source of inspiration and hope. The Barbarian Hero. There was no mistaking that shape. The wide chest, the neck like a tree trunk, the surprisingly small head under its wild thatch of black hair, looking like a tomato on a coffin. Hrun was one of the Discworld's more durable heroes, a fighter of dragons, a despoiler of temples, a hired sword, the kingpost of every street brawl. He could even speak words of more than two syllables, given time, and maybe a hint or two. From The Colour of Magic. Hrun dresses only in a leopard skin loincloth, and numerous gold armbands and anklets. It goes without saying that he is totally fearless and unimaginative, while being at the same time as alert to any danger as a cat and as lithe as a panther. His life is one long string of adventures, which don't surprise him in the least.
"Oh," said Hrun, "I expect in a minute this dungeon door will be flung back, and I will be dragged off to some sort of temple arena, where I'll fight maybe a couple of giant spiders, and an 8-foot slave from the jungles of Klatch, and then I'll rescue some kind of princess from the altar, and then kill off a few guards or whatever, and then this girl will show me a secret passage out of the palace, and we'll liberate a couple of horses, and escape with the treasure."
Hrun leaned back on his hands, and looked up at the ceiling, whistling tunelessly.
"All that?" said Two Flower.
"Usually."
Earth too knows heroes of this type, notably Conan the Barbarian from Chimeria, whose many adventures as pirate, mercenary, and eventual warlord and emperor were chronicled in America in the 1930s by the fantasy writer Robert E. Howard and others. An admirer wrote, "Conan is a true hero of Valhalla, battling and suffering great wounds by day, carousing and wenching by night, and plunging into fresh adventures tomorrow. Besides ordinary human enemies, he is forever attacking or being attacked by evil lords, sorcerers, witch queens, magical monsters, dark gods. An indestructible stone toad thing, as bulky as a buffalo, with seven green glowing eyes, crouching on an altar in a temple of lusterless black stone, whose geometry obeys no human laws, is just the kind of thing he would meet. He always wins." A barbarian hero, like his kingly counterpart, often possesses a remarkable sword. Harun's is called Kring, and he stole it from the impregnable palace of the Archimandrite of Bitunai. It is forged from black meteoric iron, with highly ornate runes on the blade and rubies on the pommel. Not only does Kring have a name of its own, it has a soul. It talks incessantly, in a voice like a claw being scraped across glass, and it has a very irritating personality. In the course of its multidimensional existence, it has, of course, starred in numerous battles, and at one point belonged to a pasha, who used it to cut silk handkerchiefs in mid-air. On the other hand, it once spent 200 years at the bottom of a lake, which was not really fun. Can this possibly mean that Kring has existed on Earth, too? That Kring and Excalibur are aspects of a single entity? And is that why Kring remarks, when stuck in a tree branch, that
"It could have been worse. It could have been an anvil."
Come to think of it, even the tree could be significant. The Volsungs, a family of Norse and Germanic heroes, had as their heirloom a sword which came to them by way of a test, very like Arthur's. Odin, the god of war, had driven it up to the hilt in a tree trunk, challenging kings and warriors to pull it out. "Whoso draweth this sword from this tree shall have the same as a gift from me, and shall find in good sooth that never bear he better sword in hand than this." Sigmund the Volsung was the only one who could draw it out, and it served him well until, in his last battle, it broke against the spear shaft of Odin himself. But when Sigmund's son grew up, he is called Sigurd in Iceland and Siegfried in Germany, he reforged the blade that was broken, naming it Gram, and became an even greater hero than his father had been. Perhaps this too is something Kring knows about. Many heroes undertake adventures just for the fun of it, while others, young Nigel in sorcery for instance, see themselves as ruled by a special kind of destiny called a geas, G-E-A-S. This is a form of the Irish word geese, G-E-I-S, and has nothing at all to do with large, waddling grey or white birds. It means an obligation, enforced by magical penalties, to do or not to do some particular thing. A hero may be born with a geese, or more than one, or someone may lay it on him. Either way, it usually spells trouble, especially if he gets into a situation where two of his geese clash. One great Irish warrior, Cú Chulainn, was trapped in this way. He was under two obligations. One was never to eat dog's flesh, which seems simple enough, but the other was never to refuse an offer of food and hospitality. So when an enemy, knowing this, invited him to a meal of dog stew, he was forced to break either one rule or the other, and was doomed. Nigel, luckily, has no such dilemma. The greatest by far of the Discworld's barbarian heroes is Coen. Anything others have done, he has done better, faster, more often. He is the bravest, the most famous. He has been an emperor in the Counterweight continent, and during this phase of his career was respectfully referred to as Genghis Coen. There is just one small problem. He is now somewhere around 90 years old. Most of the friends and foes of his younger days are dead. His surviving companions are now known as the Silver Horde. Like him, they suffer a variety of age-related afflictions, piles, deafness, toothlessness, stiff joints, and like him, they will never cease to be heroes. And yet, in the long run, what does the life of a hero amount to? Standing on a mountain peak, Coen surveys the kingdoms of the world as he sets out on his last and greatest enterprise, accompanied by the Silver Horde and a very puzzled minstrel.
"I've been to everywhere I can see," said Coen, looking around. "Been there, done that, been there again, done it twice. Nowhere left where I ain't been."
The minstrel looked him up and down, and a kind of understanding dawned. "I know why you are doing this now," he thought. "Thank goodness for a classical education. Now, what was the quote?" "And Carolinus wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer," he said.
"Who's that bloke? You mentioned him before," said Coen.
"You haven't heard of the Emperor Carolinus?"
"Nope."
"But he was the greatest conqueror that ever lived. His empire spanned the entire disk. Well, when he got as far as the coast of Muntab, it was said that he stood on the shore and wept. Some philosopher told him there were more worlds out there somewhere, and that he'd never be able to conquer them. That reminded me a bit of you. Cohen strolled along in silence for a moment.
Yeah, he said at last. Yeah, I can see how that could be. Only not a sissy, obviously.
From The Last Hero. And later, trying to explain why he and his companions mean to blow up the Mountain of the Gods, though they themselves will be killed doing it, Cohen remembers the rage and frustration of Carolinus, that the unjust gods have granted such short lives to men.
I ain't much good with words, but I reckon we're doing this 'cause we are going to die, d'ye see? And 'cause some bloke got to the edge of the world somewhere and saw all them other worlds out there and burst into tears 'cause there was only one lifetime. So much universe and so little time. And that's not right.
Carolinus, the mighty conqueror of distant kingdoms, has a counterpart in the history of ancient Greece. His name was Alexander the Great. And there are strange similarities in the careers of these two great men. The knotty problem, for one. Carolinus once came to the temple of Ophla in Tzort, where there was a huge, complicated knot tying two beams together, and it was said that whoever untied it would reign over the whole continent. Carolinus simply sliced through it with his sword and went on to build a huge empire. Was this cheating? Cohen thinks it wasn't.
It wasn't cheating, because it was a good story. I could just imagine it, too. A load of whey-faced priests and such like standing around and thinking, that's cheating, but he's got a really big sword, so I won't be the first to point this out. Plus, this damn great army is just outside.
Amazingly, exactly the same thing happened to Alexander. As a young general, he led his army into the town of Gordium, near modern Ankara in Turkey, where there was an ancient ox cart which their first king had dedicated to Zeus after tying up its axle tree with a weirdly knotted rope. It was prophesied that anyone who could untie it would rule all Asia, but nobody had managed it in over 100 years. Alexander tried, failed, and then drew his sword and cut it. That night there was a terrible thunderstorm. The priests of Zeus wisely decided this showed the approval of the gods. Another story told of him, if properly understood, shows that he felt just the same way as Carolinus and Cohen did about the limits of his achievements. It is popularly said that Alexander, at the height of his power, stood on the shores of the Indian Ocean and wept to think that there were no worlds left for him to conquer. Like so much that is popularly said, this is nonsense. It is a medieval legend, not to be found in any ancient source. Alexander was no fool. He knew perfectly well that though he had conquered Afghanistan, reached the borders of Kashmir, and then marched down the Indus Valley to the sea, there remained many more kingdoms in Asia and India which he had not defeated. Come to that, there were large tracts of Europe itself, to the north and west of Greece, where his armies had never set foot. No way could he have thought there was nothing left for him to conquer. This medieval legend distorts an older and more subtle anecdote, which is to be found in the ancient Greek author Plutarch, not in his full-scale Life of Alexander, but in an essay on contentment of the mind, in his collection of Moralia. Among the members of Alexander's court was a philosopher named Anaxarchus, who by pure reasoning achieved a remarkably modern understanding of the nature of the multiverse. According to Plutarch, Alexander wept when he heard Anaxarchus speak about the infinite number of worlds in the universe. One of Alexander's friends asked him what was the matter, and he replied, "There are so many worlds, and I have not yet conquered even one." Cohen is not alone in sharing the frustration of Carolinus and Alexander. So, in a different way, does the normally cheerful tourist Twoflower, standing at the rim of the disc and staring out at the stars.
Sometimes I think a man could wander across the disk all his life and not see all there is to see, said Two Flower. And now it seems there are lots of other worlds as well. When I think I might die without seeing a hundredth of all there is to see, it makes me feel... He paused, then added, Well, humble, I suppose. And very angry, of course.
From The Colour of Magic. It is also intriguing to note how Fortune, Lady Luck, decided the fate of both Alexander and Cohen by a throw of the dice. Writers in antiquity and in the Middle Ages argued about the influence of fortune on the life of Alexander. He had been amazingly successful as a conqueror and ruler, yet he was only 33 when he unexpectedly died, struck down by sickness, or, some believed, treacherously poisoned. So was fortune on Alexander's side or not? Did he owe his achievements to her or to his own virtues? Did she turn against him in the end? In Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the monk is certain that she did. He laments over the long list of great men who first enjoyed fortune's favours, but whom she then betrayed. One of them is Alexander, at one time the heir of her honour, till she destroyed him in a game of dice, where she magically transformed his winning throw, a six, into the lowest possible one. O worthy noble Alexander! O alas that you should ever fall in such a case! Poisoned by people of your own you were. Your six did fortune change into an ace, and yet she never wept for you one tear. In the Discworld, Cohen accepts a challenge to roll dice against the harsh god Fate, not against Fortune the Lady. Fate throws a six, and tells Cohen that to win he must throw a seven, though the die is a perfectly normal one, with only the regulation six sides.
So, seven and I win, said Cohen. It comes down showing seven, and I win, right?
Yes, of course, said Fate.
Sounds like a million to one chance to me, said Cohen.
He tossed the die high in the air, and it slowed as it rose, tumbling glacially with a noise like the swish of windmill blades. It reached the top of its arc and began to fall. Cohen was staring fixedly at it, absolutely still. Then his sword was out of its scabbard, and it whirled around in a complex curve. There was a snick and a green flash in the middle of the air, and two halves of an ivory cube bounced across the table. One landed showing the six, the other landed showing the one. From The Last Hero. The situation is not without precedent on the Discworld. A five thrown by the lady turns into a seven in The Colour of Magic, or even in our own world, where it is said that King Olaf of Norway played dice against the King of Sweden for a disputed island, and won when his die accidentally split in half, one face showing the six and the other the one. Nevertheless, Fate accuses Cohen of cheating, and would have reneged on the bargain if the lady, whom none of the gods ever opposes, had not intervened on Cohen's behalf. But Cohen does not appreciate the favour.
"And who are you?"
snapped Cohen, still red with rage.
I am the million to one chance," she said. "Yeah?" said Cohen, less impressed than the minstrel thought he ought to be. "And who are all the other chances?"
"I am those also,"
Cohen sniffed.
"Then you ain't no lady."
"That's not really," the minstrel began.
"Oh, that wasn't what I was supposed to say, was it?"
said Cohen.
"I was supposed to say, oh, tar, missus, much obliged. Well, I ain't. They say fortune favours the brave, but I say I've seen too many brave men walking into battles they never walked out of. The hell with all of it."
From The Last Hero. Nothing, not even a marvel that has saved his own life, can persuade Cohen to give up his fury at the injustice of old age and inevitable death. Those who want a happy ending every time had better steer clear of epic poetry and heroic sagas, for the wages of heroism is death. True, there are a few legendary heroes who vanish into fairyland, but the great majority die by violence, and their deaths are at least as memorable as their lives. Some fall in battle against overwhelming odds, as did Charlemagne's noble warriors, Roland and Oliver, facing a Saracen army at Roncesvalles. Some, like the Irish Cú Chulainn and the Danish Hrólf Kraki, die because the enemy host is strengthened by the spells of evil magicians and malevolent deities. Some are murdered by the treachery of trusted relatives or comrades, as were Sigurd the Dragon Slayer and Robin Hood. On the other hand, death is what offers a hero the finest chance to display his mettle. An Anglo-Saxon poet put these words into the mouth of an aging English warrior, facing certain defeat and death in battle against Vikings at Maldon in Essex in 991. "Our minds shall mount higher, our hearts beat harder, our spirits grow stronger, as strength dwindles." Always, at the last, there is the burial mound, the funeral pyre, the death ship, which may be set on fire or simply pushed out to sea, as was done for Skild Skifing, a legendary Danish king. "The prince's ship, with curving prow, glinting with hoar frost, eager to leave, lay in the harbour. They laid their dear lord, the ring-giver, in the ship's bosom beside the mast, and treasures, too, from far-off lands. High over his head a banner hung, gold embroidered. They let the waters bear him away, trusted him to the ocean. Sad were their hearts." From Beowulf. Or, as Cohen puts it, remembering one of his old comrades,
"Where would he have been if we weren't there to give him a proper funeral, eh? A great big bonfire. That's the funeral of a hero. And everyone else said he was a waste of a good boat."
From The Last Hero. And where was the boat heading? Well, there was always the possibility of Valhalla, or the Elysian Fields, or the Happy Isles. But ancient epics and sagas have little to say on this point. What mattered far more was that the hero should be remembered. It was said of Sigurd that his name will last as long as the world endures. And the same was, or should be, true of every hero, as the old Icelandic poem Havamal puts it. "Cattle die, kinsmen die, and each man too shall die. I know one thing that never dies, a dead man's reputation." An eye-catching grave is useful publicity too. Not for nothing did Beowulf's people cover his ashes with a large mound high on a headland where every passing ship would see it. But the centuries roll on and memories fade. We can make a fair guess at who lies in the royal barrow at Sutton Hoo in Suffolk, but there are dozens upon dozens of mounds along the South Downs and on Salisbury Plain that were raised for men whose names and deeds are now utterly forgotten. Which is wrong. Which is why Cohen is found one day sitting on an ancient burial mound and refusing to come back into camp for dinner, because he
hadn't finished.
"Finished what, old friend?"
"Remembering," said Cohen.
"Remembering who?"
"The hero who was buried here, all right."
"Who was he?"
"Dunno."
"What were his people?"
"Search me," said Cohen.
"Did he do any mighty deeds?"
"Couldn't say."
"Then why?"
"Someone's got to remember the poor bugger."
"You don't know anything about him."
"I can still remember him."
From The Last Hero. Time also creates a problem for the rare hero who does not die young. Is it fitting for him to settle down quietly, while old age, the enemy he can never conquer or outwit, advances steadily upon him? Is he to lie in his bed, old and sick, meekly waiting for death? A straw death, as Vikings would mockingly call it. Of course, fate might send him, even in old age, the chance of a last good fight. Beowulf had been a king for 50 years when he went to face the dragon. But if not, well, it is in the nature of heroes to rage against the dying of the light. In history, one of the great medieval warlords of Asia was the Mongolian Timur Ilenk, called Tamerlane by Westerners, who was descended on his mother's side from Genghis Khan. His empire was centered in Samarkand, and stretched from Turkey to the Ganges Valley and the borders of China. He died a natural death in 1405, at the age of 72, while making plans to invade China itself. According to legend, as told by the Elizabethan playwright Marlowe, who called him Tamburlaine, on his deathbed he declared war on the gods for striking him down. "What daring god torments my body thus, and seeks to conquer mighty Tamburlaine? Shall sickness prove me now to be a man, that have been termed the terror of the world? Tekeles and the rest, come, take your swords and threaten him whose hand afflicts my soul. Come, let us march against the powers of heaven, and set black banners in the firmament, to signify the slaughter of the gods." He may not have been the only one who refused to go quietly. Odysseus may have done the same, though less fiercely. In Homer's Odyssey, we hear how this resourceful hero, whose cleverness led to the Greek victory in the Trojan War, eventually got home to his island kingdom of Ithaca, after 10 years of struggling against monsters, enchantments, and shipwrecks. And there, Homer leaves him, happily reunited with his wife Penelope, to grow old in peace. But did he? 1,000 years later, Dante, who like all Italians called him Ulysses, thought his story ended differently. The bonds of family and homeland could not overcome his passion to learn more about the world. So he set sail with a small band of his faithful comrades, all grown old, urging them on towards the lands beyond the sun. "Men were not made to live like brutes," he said, "but to pursue knowledge and excellence." They sailed through the Straits of Gibraltar and out into the deep ocean, past the equator and far southwards, till they saw a towering mountain, which, though they did not know it, was the Mount of Purgatory, crowned with the earthly paradise. But there came a whirlwind from this unknown land, and spun their ship 3 times round and sank it, and thus ended the life of Ulysses. In Victorian times, Tennyson took up the theme. In his poem, Ulysses, the aged hero looks back on a life spent always roaming with a hungry heart, and resolves never to pause, never to make an end, but still, to follow knowledge like a sinking star, beyond the utmost bound of human thought. He gathers his former comrades, urging them to defy the years and the approach of death, and join him on a last voyage into the unknown. "For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset, and the baths of all the western stars, until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the Happy Isles, and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Cohen and the Silver Horde would have understood.